and the candidate, looking on, begins to feel that great heaving sun-blazing deathboard of a deck wallowing in his own vestibular system, and suddenly he finds himself backed up against his own limits. He ends up going to the flight surgeon with so-called conversion symptoms. Overnight, he develops blurred vision or numbness in his hands and feet or sinusitis so severe that he cannot tolerate changes in altitude. On one level, the symptom is real. He cannot see too well or use his fingers or stand the pain. But somewhere in his subconscious, he knows it is a plea and a beg-off. He shows not the slightest concern. The flight surgeon notes that the condition might be permanent and affect him in whatever life awaits him outside the arena of the right stuff. Those who remain, those who qualified for carrier duty, and even more so, those who later on qualified for night carrier duty, began to feel a bit like Gideon's warriors. So many have been left behind. The young warriors were now treated to a deathly sweet and quite unmentionable sight. They could gaze at length upon the crushed and wilted pariahs who had washed out. They could inspect those who did not have that righteous stuff. The military did not have very merciful instincts. Rather than packing up those poor souls and sending them home, the Navy, like the Air Force and the Marines, would try to make use of them in some other role, such as flight controller. So the washout has to keep taking classes with the rest of his group, even though he can no longer touch an airplane. He sits there in the classes, staring at sheets of paper with cataracts of sheer human mortification over his eyes, while the rest still looks at him. This man reduced to an ant, this untouchable, this poor son of a bitch. And in what test had he been found wanting? Why, it seemed to be nothing less than manhood itself. Naturally, this was never mentioned either. Yet there it was. Manliness, manhood, manly courage. There was something ancient, primordial, irresistible about the challenge of this stuff. No matter what a sophisticated and rational age one might think he lived in. Perhaps because it could not be talked about, the subject began to take on superstitious and even mystical outlines. A man either had it or he didn't. There was no such thing as having most of it. Moreover, it could blow at any seam. One day a man could be ascending the pyramid at a terrific clip, and the next, bingo, he would reach his own limits in the most unexpected way. Conrad and Shirah met an Air Force pilot who had a great pal at Tyndall Air Force Base in Florida. This man had been the budding ace of the training class. He had flown the hottest fighter-style trainer, the T-38, like a dream, and then he began the routine step of being checked out in the T-33. The T-33 was not nearly as hot an aircraft as the T-38. It was essentially an old P-80 jet fighter. It had an exceedingly small cockpit. The pilot could barely move his shoulders. It was the sort of airplane of which everybody said, "You get into that, you wear it." Once inside a T-33 cockpit, this man, this budding ace, developed claustrophobia of the most paralyzing sort. He tried everything to overcome it. He even went to a psychiatrist, which was a serious mistake for a military officer if his superiors learned of it. But nothing worked. He was shifted over to flying jet transports, such as the C-135. Very demanding and necessary aircraft they were, too, and he was still spoken of as an excellent pilot. But as everyone knew, and again, it was never explained in so many words, only those who were assigned to fighter squadrons, the fighter jocks, as they called each other with a self-satisfied irony, remained in the true fraternity. Those assigned to transports were not humiliated like washouts. Somebody had to fly those planes. Nevertheless, they too had been left behind for lack of the right stuff. Or a man could go for a routine physical one day, feeling like $1 million and be grounded for fallen arches. It happened, just like that. And try raising him, huh? Or for breaking his wrist and losing only part of his mobility. Or for a minor deterioration of eyesight, or for any of hundreds of reasons that would make no difference to a man in an ordinary occupation. As a result, all fighter jocks began looking upon doctors as their natural enemies. Going to see a flight surgeon was a no-gain proposition. A pilot could only hold his own or lose in the doctor's office. To be grounded for a medical reason was no humiliation looked at objectively, but it was a humiliation nonetheless, for it meant that you no longer had that indefinable, unutterable, integral stuff. It could blow at any scene. All the hot young fighter jocks began trying to test the limits themselves in a superstitious way. They were like believing Presbyterians of a century before who used to probe their own experience to see if they were truly among the elect. When a fighter pilot was in training, whether in the Navy or the Air Force, his superiors were continually spelling out strict rules for him about the use of the aircraft and conduct in the sky. They repeatedly forbade so-called hot dog stunts, such as outside loops, buzzing, flat-hatting, hedge-hopping, and flying under bridges. But somehow, one got the message that the man who truly had it could ignore those rules. Not that he should make a point of it, but that he could. And that after all, there was only one way to find out. And then in some strange unofficial way, peeking through his fingers, his instructor halfway expected him to challenge all the limits. They would give a lecture about how a pilot should never fly without a good solid breakfast, eggs, bacon, toast, and so forth, because if he tried to fly with his blood sugar level too low, it could impair his alertness. Naturally, the next day, every hot dog in the unit would get up and have a breakfast consisting of one cup of black coffee and take off and go up in a vertical climb until the weight of the ship exactly canceled out the upward thrust of the engine and his airspeed was zero. And he would hang there for one thick adrenal instant and then fall like a rock until one of three things happened. He keeled over, nose first, and regained his aerodynamics and all was well. He went into a spin and fought his way out of it, or he went into a spin and had to eject or crunch it, which was always supremely possible. Likewise, hassling, mock dogfighting, was strictly forbidden, and so, naturally, young fighter jocks could hardly wait to go up in, say, a pair of F-100s and start the duel by making a pass at each other at 800 miles an hour. The winner being the pilot who could slip in behind the other and get locked in on his tail, wax his tail. And it was not uncommon for some eager jock to try too tight an outside turn and have his engine flame out. Whereupon, unable to restart it, he has to eject. And he shakes his fist at the victor and he floats down by parachute and his million-dollar aircraft goes kaboom on the palmetto grass or the desert floor. And he starts thinking about how he can get together with the other guy back at the base in time for the two of them to get their story straight before the investigation. I don't know what happened, sir. I was pulling up after a target run, and it just flamed out on me. Hassling was forbidden, and hassling that led to the destruction of an aircraft was a serious court-martial offense. And the man's superiors knew that the engine hadn't just flamed out. But every unofficial impulse on the base seemed to be saying, hell, we wouldn't give you a nickel for a pilot who hasn't done some crazy rat racing like that. It's all part of the right stuff. The other side of this impulse showed up in the reluctance of the young jocks to admit it when they had maneuvered themselves into a bad corner they couldn't get out of. There were two reasons why a fighter pilot hated to declare an emergency. First, it triggered a complex and very public chain of events at the field. All other incoming flights were held up, including many of one's comrades who were probably low on fuel. The fire trucks came trundling out to the runway like yellow toys as seen from way up there, the better to illustrate one's hapless state. And the bureaucracy began to crank up the paper monster for the investigation that always followed. And second, to declare an emergency, one first had to reach that conclusion in his own mind, which, to the young pilot, was the same as saying, a minute ago I still had it, now I need your help. To have a bunch of young fighter pilots up in the air thinking this way used to drive flight controllers crazy. They would see a ship beginning to drift off the radar, and they couldn't rouse the pilot on the microphone for anything other than a few meaningless mumbles, and they would know he was probably out there with an engine failure at a low altitude, trying to reignite by lowering his auxiliary generator rig, which had a little propeller that was supposed to spin in the slipstream like a child's pinwheel. Whiskey, Kilo 28, do you want to declare an emergency? This would rouse him to say, negative, negative, Whiskey, Kilo 28 is not declaring an emergency. Kaboom. Believers in the right stuff would rather crash and burn. One fine day, after he joined a fighter squadron, it would dawn on the young pilot exactly how the losers in the great fraternal competition were now being left behind, which is to say, not by instructors or other superiors or by failures at prescribed levels of competence, but by death. At this point, the essence of the Enterprise would begin to dawn on him. Slowly, step by step, the ante had been raised until he was now involved in what was surely the grimmest and grandest gamble of manhood. Being a fighter pilot, for that matter, simply taking off in a single-engine jet fighter of the Century series, such as an F-102 or any of the military's other marvelous bricks with fins on them, presented a man on a perfectly sunny day with more ways to get himself killed than his wife and children could imagine in their wildest fears. If he was barreling down the runway at 200 miles an hour, completing the takeoff run, and the board started lighting up red, should he, A, abort the takeoff and try to wrestle with a monster which was gorged with jet fuel out in the sand beyond the end of the runway, or B, eject and hope that the goddamn human cannonball trick works at zero altitude and he doesn't shatter an elbow or a kneecap on the way out, or C, continue the takeoff and deal with the problem aloft, knowing full well that the ship may be on fire and therefore seconds away from exploding. He would have 1 second to sort out the options and act, and this kind of little workaday decision came up all the time. Occasionally, a man would look coldly at the binary problem he was now confronting every day, right stuff slash death, and decide it wasn't worth it, and voluntarily shift over to transports or reconnaissance or whatever. And his comrades would wonder for a day or so what evil virus had invaded his soul as they left him behind. More often, however, the reverse would happen. Some college graduate would enter Navy aviation through the reserve, simply as an alternative to the Army draft, fully intending to return to civilian life to some waiting profession or family business, would become involved in the obsessive business of ascending the ziggurat pyramid of flying, and at the end of his enlistment would astound everyone back home and very likely himself as well by signing up for another one. What on earth got into him? He couldn't explain it. After all, the very words for it had been amputated. A Navy study showed that 2/3 of the fighter pilots who were rated in the top rungs of their groups, i.e. the hottest young pilots, re-enlisted when the time came, and practically all were college graduates. By this point, a young fighter jock was like the preacher in Moby Dick, who climbs up into the pulpit on a rope ladder and then pulls the ladder up behind him. Except the pilot could not use the words necessary to express the vital lessons. Civilian life and even home and hearth now seemed not only far away, but far below. Back down many levels of the pyramid of the right stuff. A fighter pilot soon found he wanted to associate only with other fighter pilots. Who else could understand the nature of the little proposition, right stuff slash death, they were all dealing with? And what other subject could compare with it? It was riveting. To talk about it in so many words was forbidden, of course. The very words death, danger, bravery, fear were not to be uttered except in the occasional specific instance or for ironic effect. Nevertheless, the subject could be adumbrated in code or by example. Hence the endless evenings of pilots huddled together talking about flying. On these long and drunken evenings, the bane of their family life, certain theorems would be propounded and demonstrated. and all by code, an example. One theorem was, there are no accidents and no fatal flaws in the machines. There are only pilots with the wrong stuff, i.e., blind fate can't kill me. When Bud Jennings crashed and burned in the swamps of Jacksonville, the other pilots in Pete Conrad's squadron said, how could he have been so stupid? It turned out that Jennings had gone up in the SNJ with his cockpit canopy opened in a way that was expressly forbidden in the manual, and carbon monoxide had been sucked in from the exhaust, and he passed out and crashed. All agreed that Bud Jennings was a good guy and a good pilot, but his epitaph on the ziggurat was, how could he have been so stupid? This seemed shocking at first, but by the time Conrad had reached the end of that bad string at Pax River, he was capable of his own corollary to the theorem, viz., no single factor ever killed a pilot. There was always a chain of mistakes. But what about Ted Whelan, who fell like a rock from 8,100 feet when his parachute failed? Well, the parachute was merely part of the chain. First, someone should have caught the structural defect that resulted in the hydraulic leak that triggered the emergency. Second, Whelan did not check out his seat parachute rig, and the drogue failed to separate the main parachute from the seat. But even after those two mistakes, Whelan had 15 or 20 seconds as he fell to disengage himself from the seat and open the parachute manually. Why just stare at the scenery coming up to smack you in the face? And everyone nodded. He failed, but I wouldn't have. Once the theorem and the corollary were understood, the Navy's statistics about one in every four Navy aviators dying meant nothing. The figures were averages, and averages applied to those with average stuff. A riveting subject, especially if it were one's own hide that were on the line. Every evening, at bases all over America, there were military pilots huddled in officers' clubs, eagerly cutting the right stuff up in coated slices so they could talk about it. What more compelling topic of conversation was there in the world? In the Air Force, there were even pilots who would ask the tower for priority landing clearance so they could make the beer call on time at 4 p.m. sharp at the officers' club. They would come right out and state the reason. The drunken rambles began at 4 and sometimes went on for 10 or 12 hours. Such conversations. They diced that righteous stuff up into little bits, bowed ironically to it, stumbled, blindfolded around it, groped, lurched, belched, staggered, bawled, sang, roared, and fainted at it with self-deprecating humor. Nevertheless, they never mentioned it by name. No, they used approved codes such as, like a jerk, I got myself into a hell of a corner today. They told of how they lucked out of it. To get across the extreme peril of his exploit, one would use certain oblique cues. He would say, I looked over at Robinson, who would be known to the listeners as a non-com, who sometimes rode backseat to read radar, and he wasn't talking anymore. He was just staring at the radar like this, giving it that zombie look. Then I knew I was in trouble. Beautiful, just right, for it would also be known to the listeners that the non-coms advised one another. Never fly with a lieutenant. Avoid captains and majors. Hell, man, do yourself a favor. Don't fly with anybody below colonel. Which in turn said, those young bucks shot dice with death. And yet once in the air, the non-com had his own standards. He was determined to remain as outwardly cool as the pilot, so that when the pilot did something that truly petrified him, he would say nothing. Instead, he would turn silent, catatonic, like a zombie. Perfect zombie. There you had it, compressed into a single word all of the foregoing. I'm a hell of a pilot, I shoot dice with death, and now all you fellas know it. And I haven't spoken of that unspoken stuff even once. The talking and drinking began at the beer call, and then the boys would break for dinner and come back afterwards and get more wasted and more garrulous, or else more quietly fried, drinking good cheap PX booze until 2 a.m. The night was young. Why not get the cars and go out for a little proficiency run? It seemed that every fighter jock thought himself an ace driver, and he would do anything to obtain a hot car, especially a sports car. And the drunker he was, the more convinced he would be about his driving skills. As if the right stuff, being indivisible, carried over into any enterprise whatsoever, under any condition. A little proficiency run, boys. There's only one way to find out, and they would roar off in close formation from, say, Nellis Air Force Base down Route 15 into Las Vegas, barreling down the highway, rat racing, sometimes four abreast, jockeying for position, piling into the most listless curve in the desert flats, as if they were trying to root each other out of the groove at the Rebel 500, and then bursting into downtown Las Vegas with a rude fraternal roar like the Hell's Angels. And the natives chalked it up to youth and drink and the bad element that the Air Force attracted. They knew nothing about the right stuff, of course. More fighter pilots died in automobiles than in airplanes. Fortunately, there was always some kindly soul up the chain to certify the papers, line of duty, so that the widow could get a better break on the insurance. That was okay and only proper because somehow the system itself had long ago said skull. And quite right, to the military cycle of flying and drinking and driving, as if there were no other way. Every young fighter jock knew the feeling of getting 2 or 3 hours sleep and then waking up at 5:30 a.m. and having a few cups of coffee, a few cigarettes, and then carting his poor quivering liver out to the field for another day of flying. There were those who arrived not merely hungover, but still drunk, slapping oxygen tank cones over their faces and trying to burn the alcohol out of their systems, and then going up, remarking later, "I don't advise it, you understand, but it can be done, provided you have the right stuff, you miserable pudknocker." Air Force and Navy airfields were usually on barren and marginal stretches of land that would have looked especially bleak and low rent to an ordinary individual in the chilly light of dawn. But to a young pilot, there was an inexplicable bliss to coming out to the flight line while the sun was just beginning to cook up behind the rim of the horizon, so that the whole field was still in shadow and the ridges in the distance were in silhouette and the flight line was a monochrome of exhaust fume blue and every little red light on top of the water towers or power stations looked dull, shriveled, congealed, and the runway lights, which were still on, looked faded. And even the landing lights on a fighter that had just landed and was taxiing in were no longer dazzling as they would be at night, and looked instead like shriveled gobs of candle power out there. And yet it was beautiful, exhilarating, for he was revved up with adrenaline, anxious to take off before the day broke, to burst up into the sunlight over the ridges before all those thousands of comatose souls down there, still dead to the world, snug in home and hearth, even came to their senses. To take off in an F-100 at dawn and cut in the afterburner and hurtle 25,000 feet up into the sky, so suddenly that you felt not like a bird, but like a trajectory. Yet with full control of 5 tons of thrust, all of which flowed from your will and through your fingertips, with a huge engine right beneath you, so close that it was as if you were riding it bareback until you leveled out and went supersonic, an event registered on Earth by a tremendous cracking boom that shook windows. But up here, only by the fact that you now felt utterly free of the earth. To describe it, even to wife, child, near ones, and dear ones seemed impossible. So the pilot kept it to himself, along with an even more indescribable, and even more sinfully inconfessible, feeling of superiority, appropriate to him and to his kind, lone bearers of the right stuff. From up here, at dawn, the pilot looked down upon poor, hopeless Las Vegas, or Yuma, Corpus Christi, Meridian, San Bernardino, or Dayton, and began to wonder, How can all of them down there, those poor souls who will soon be waking up and trudging out of their minute rectangles and inching along the little noodle highways toward whatever slots and grooves make up their everyday lives, how could they live like that with such earnestness? If they had the faintest idea of what it was like up here in this righteous zone. But of course, not only the washed out grounded and dead pilots had been left behind, but also all of those millions of sleepwalking souls who never attempted the great gamble. The entire world below, left behind. Only at this point can one begin to understand just how big, how titanic the ego of the military pilot could be. The world was used to enormous egos in artists, actors, entertainers of all sorts, and politicians, sport figures, and even journalists, because they had such familiar and convenient ways to show them off. But that slim young man over there in uniform with the enormous watch on his wrist and the withdrawn look on his face, that young officer who is so shy he can't even open his mouth unless the subject is flying, that young pilot, well, my friends, his ego is even bigger. So big, it's breathtaking. Even in the 1950s, it was difficult for civilians to comprehend such a thing. But all military officers and many enlisted men tended to feel superior to civilians. It was really quite ironic, given the fact that for a good 30 years, the rising business classes in the cities had been steering their sons away from the military, as if from a bad smell, and the officer corps had never been held in lower esteem. Well, career officers returned the contempt in trumps. They looked upon themselves as men who lived by higher standards of behavior than civilians, as men who were bearers and protectors of the most important values of American life, who maintained a sense of discipline while civilians abandoned themselves to hedonism, who maintained a sense of honor while civilians lived by opportunism and greed. Opportunism and greed. There you had your much-vaunted corporate business world. Khrushchev was right about one thing. When it came time to hang the capitalist West, an American businessman would sell him the rope. When the showdown came, and the showdowns always came, not all the wealth in the world or all the sophisticated nuclear weapons and radar and missile systems it could buy would take the place of those who had the uncritical willingness to face danger, those who, in short, had the right stuff. In fact, the feeling was so righteous, so exalted, it could become religious. Civilians seldom understood this either. There was no one to teach them. It was no longer the fashion for serious writers to describe the glories of war. Instead, they dwelt upon its horrors, often with cynicism or disgust. It was left to the occasional pilot with a literary flair to provide a glimpse of the pilot's self-conception in its heavenly or spiritual aspect. When a pilot named Robert Scott flew his P-43 over Mount Everest, quite a feat at the time, he brought his hand up and snapped a salute to his fallen adversary. He thought he had defeated the mountain, surmounting all the forces of nature that made it formidable. And why not? God is my co-pilot, he said. That became the title of his book, and he meant it. So did the most gifted of all the pilot authors, the Frenchman, Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. As he gazed down upon the world, from up there, during transcontinental flights, the good Saint X saw civilization as a series of tiny, fragile patches clinging to the otherwise barren rock of the earth. He felt like a lonely sentinel, a protector of those vulnerable little oases, ready to lay down his life in their behalf if necessary, a saint, in short, true to his name, flying up there at the right hand of God, the good Saint X. And he was not the only one. He was the one who put it into words most beautifully and anointed himself before the altar of the right stuff. There were many pilots in their 30s who, to the consternation of their wives, children, mothers, fathers, and employers, volunteered to go active in the reserves and fly in combat in the Korean War, in godforsaken frozen Chosin. But it was simple enough. Half of them were flyers who had trained during the Second World War and had never seen combat. It was well understood, and never said, of course, that no one could reach the top of the pyramid without going into combat. The morale of foot soldiers in the Korean War was so bad, it actually reached the point where officers were prodding men forward with gun barrels and bayonets. But in the air, it was fighter jock heaven. Using F-86s, mainly, the Air Force was producing aces, pilots who had shot down five planes or more, as fast as the Koreans and Chinese could get their Soviet MiG-15s up to fight them. By the time the fighting was stopped, there were 38 Air Force aces, and they had accounted for a total of 299.5 kills. Only 56 F-86s were lost. High spirits these lads had. They chronicled their adventures with a good creamy romanticism such as nobody in flying had treated himself to since the days of Lufbery, Frank Luke, and von Richthofen in the First World War. Colonel Harrison R. Thing, who shot down five MiGs in Korea and eight German and Japanese planes in the Second World War, glowed like Excalibur when he described his fourth fighter interceptor wing. Like olden knights, the F-86 pilots ride up over North Korea to the Yalu River, the sun glinting off silver aircraft, contrails streaming behind as they challenge the numerically superior enemy to come up and fight. Lances and plumes. I'm a knight. Come up and fight. Why hold back? Knights of the right stuff. When a pilot named Gus Grissom, whom Conrad, Sherrod, Lovell, and the others would meet later on, first went to Korea, the Air Force used to take the F-86 jocks out to the field before dawn, in the dark, in buses, and the pilots who had not been shot at by a MiG in air-to-air combat had to stand up. At first, Grissom couldn't believe it, and then he couldn't bear it. Those bastards sitting down were the only ones with the right stuff. The next morning, as they rumbled out there in the dark, he was sitting down. He had gone up north toward the Yalu on the first day and had it out with some howling supersonic Chinese just so he could have a seat on the bus. Even at the level of combat, the main thing was not to be left behind. Combat had its own infinite series of tests, and one of the greatest sins was chattering or jabbering on the radio. The combat frequency was to be kept clear of all but strategically essential messages, and all unenlightening comments were regarded as evidence of funk, of the wrong stuff. A Navy pilot, in legend at any rate, began shouting, "I've got a MiG at zero, I've got a MiG at zero," meaning that it had maneuvered in behind him and was locked in on his tail. An irritated voice cut in and said, "Shut up and die like an aviator." One had to be a Navy pilot to appreciate the final nuance. A good Navy pilot was a real aviator. In the Air Force, they merely had pilots, and not precisely the proper stuff. No, the tests were never ending. And in the periods between wars, a man's past successes in combat did not necessarily keep him at the top of the heavenly pyramid. By the late 50s, there was yet another plateau to strive for. On that plateau were men who had flown in combat in the Second World War or Korea and had then gone on to become test pilots in the new age of jet and rocket engines. Not every combat pilot could make the climb. Two of the great aces of the Second World War, Richard I. Bong and Don Gentile, tried it but didn't have the patience for the job. They only wanted to go up and poke holes in the sky, and presently, they were just part of combat history. Of course, by now, thanks to the accident of age, you began to find young men who had reached the exalted level of test pilot without ever having had a chance to fight in combat. One was Pete Conrad, who was just graduating with the survivors of Group 20 to the status of full-fledged test pilot at Pax River. Like every Navy test pilot, Conrad was proud of Pax River and its reputation. Out loud, every true Navy aviator insisted that Pax River was the place, and inwardly knew it really wasn't. For every military pilot knew where the apex of the Great Ziggurat was located. You could point it out on a map. The place was Edwards Air Force Base in the high desert, 150 miles northeast of Los Angeles. Everyone knew who resided there, too, although their actual status was never put into words. Not only that, everyone knew the name of the individual who ranked foremost in the Olympus, the ace of all the aces, as it were, among the true brothers of the right stuff. Chapter 3. Jaeger. Anyone who travels very much on airlines in the United States soon gets to know the voice of the airline pilot coming over the intercom with a particular drawl, a particular folksiness, a particular down-home calmness that is so exaggerated it begins to parody itself. Nevertheless, it's reassuring. The voice that tells you as the airliner is caught in thunderheads and goes bolting up and down 1,000 feet in a single gulp to check your seat belts because it might get a little choppy. The voice that tells you on a flight from Phoenix preparing for its final approach into Kennedy Airport, New York, just after dawn. Now, folks, this is the captain. We got a little old red light up here on the control panel. It's trying to tell us that the landing gear is not, locking into position when we lower them. Now, I don't believe that little old red light knows what it's talking about. I believe it's that little old red light that isn't working right. Faint chuckle, long pause, as if to say, I'm not even sure all this is really worth going into. Still, it might amuse you, but I guess to play it by the rules, we gotta humor that little old light. So we're going to take her down to about, 200 or 300 feet over the runway at Kennedy, and the folks down there on the ground are going to see if they can't give us a visual inspection of those old landing gears, with which he is obviously on intimate old buddy terms, as with every other working part of this mighty ship. And if I'm right, they're going to tell us everything is copacetic all the way around, and we'll just take her on in. And, after a couple of low passes over the field, the voice returns. Well, folks, those folks down there on the ground, it must be too early for them. I expect they still got the sleepers in their eyes, because they can't tell if those old landing gears are all the way down or not. But, you know, up here in the cockpit, we're convinced they're all the way down, so we're just going to take her on in. And, oh, I almost forgot. While we take a little swing out over the ocean and empty some of that surplus fuel we're not going to be needing anymore, that's what you might be seeing coming out of the wings. Our lovely little ladies, if they'll be so kind, they're going to go up and down the aisles and show you how we do what we call assuming the position. Another faint chuckle. We do this so often and it's so much fun, we even have a funny little name for it. And the stewardesses, a bit grimmer by the looks of them than that voice, start telling the passengers to take their glasses off and take the ballpoint pens and other sharp objects out of their pockets, and they show them the position with the head lowered. While down on the field at Kennedy, the little yellow emergency trucks start roaring across the field, and even though in your pounding heart and your sweating palms and your boiling brain pan, you know this is a critical moment in your life, you still can't quite bring yourself to believe it, because if it were, how could the captain, the man who knows the actual situation most intimately, how could he keep on drawling and chuckling and drifting and lollygagging in that particular voice of his? Well, who doesn't know that voice, and who can forget it, even after he is proved right and the emergency is over? That particular voice may sound vaguely southern or southwestern, but it is specifically Appalachian in origin. It originated in the mountains of West Virginia, in the coal country, in Lincoln County, so far up in the hollows that, as the saying went, they had to pipe in daylight. In the late 1940s and early 50s, this up-hollow voice drifted down from on high, from over the high desert of California, down, down, down from the upper reaches of the Brotherhood into all faces of American aviation. It was amazing. It was Pygmalion in reverse. Military pilots, and then soon, airline pilots, pilots from Maine and Massachusetts and the Dakotas and Oregon and everywhere else began to talk in that Poker Hollow, West Virginia drawl, or as close to it as they could bend their native accents. It was the drawl of the most righteous of all the possessors of the right stuff, Chuck Yeager. Yeager had started out as the equivalent in the Second World War of the legendary Frank Luke of the 27th Aero Squadron in the 1st, which is to say he was the boondocker, the boy from the backcountry with only a high school education, no credentials, no cachet or polish of any sort, who took off the feed store overalls and put on a uniform and climbed into an airplane and lit up the skies over Europe. Yeager grew up in Hamlin, West Virginia, a town on the Mud River not far from Nitro. Hurricane, whirlwind, salt rock, mud, sod, crumb, leet, dolly, Ruth, and Alum Creek. His father was a gas driller, drilling for natural gas in the coal fields. His older brother was a gas driller, and he would have been a gas driller had he not enlisted in the Army Air Force in 1941 at the age of 18. In 1943, at 20, he became a flight officer, i.e. a non-com, who was allowed to fly and went to England to fly fighter planes over France and Germany. Even in the tumult of the war, Yeager was somewhat puzzling to a lot of other pilots. He was a short, wiry, but muscular little guy, with dark curly hair and a tough-looking face that seemed to strangers to be saying, "You best not be looking me in the eye, you peckerwood, or I'll put four more holes in your nose." But that wasn't what was puzzling. What was puzzling was the way Yeager talked. He seemed to talk with some older forms of English elocution, syntax, and conjugation that had been preserved up hollow in the Appalachians. There were people up there who never said they disapproved of anything. They said, "I don't hold with it." In the present tense, they were willing to help out like anyone else, but in the past tense, they only hoped. "It weren't nothing I hold with, but I hoped him out with it anyways." In the first 8 missions, at the age of 20, Yeager shot down 2 German fighters. On his 9th, he was shot down over German-occupied French territory, suffering flak wounds. He bailed out, was picked up by the French underground, which smuggled him across the Pyrenees into Spain, disguised as a peasant. In Spain, he was jailed briefly, then released, whereupon he made it back to England and returned to combat during the Allied invasion of France. On October 12, 1944, Yeager took on and shot down 5 German fighter planes in succession. On November 6, flying a propeller-driven P-51 Mustang, he shot down one of the new jet fighters the Germans had developed, the Messerschmitt 262, and damaged 2 more. And on November 20th, he shot down 4 FW-190s. It was a true Frank Luke-style display of warrior fury and personal prowess. By the end of the war, he had 13 and a half kills. He was 22 years old. In 1946 and 1947, Yeager had trained as a test pilot at Wright Field in Dayton. He amazed his instructors with his ability at stunt team flying, not to mention the unofficial business of hassling. That, plus his up-hollow drawl, had everybody saying, "He's a natural-born stick and rudder man." Nevertheless, there was something extraordinary about it when a man so young, with so little experience in flight tests, was selected to go to Muroc Field in California for the XS-1 project. Muroc was up in the high elevations of the Mojave Desert. It looked like some fossil landscape that had long since been left behind by the rest of the terrestrial evolution. It was full of huge dry lake beds, the biggest being Rogers Lake. Other than sagebrush, the only vegetation was Joshua trees, twisted freaks of the plant world that looked like a cross between cactus and Japanese bonsai. They had a dark petrified green color and horribly crippled branches. At dusk, the Joshua trees stood out in silhouette on the fossil wasteland like some arthritic nightmare. In the summer, the temperature went up to 110 degrees as a matter of course, and the dry lake beds were covered in sand, and there would be windstorms and sandstorms right out of a Foreign Legion movie. At night, it would drop to near freezing, and in December, it would start raining, and the dry lakes would fill up with a few inches of water, and some sort of putrid prehistoric shrimps would work their way up from out of the ooze, and seagulls would come flying in 100 miles or more from the ocean over the mountains to gobble up these squirming little throwbacks. A person had to see it to believe it. Flocks of seagulls wheeling around in the air out in the middle of the high desert in the dead of winter and grazing on antediluvian crustaceans in the primordial ooze. When the wind blew the few inches of water back and forth across the lake beds, they became absolutely smooth and level. And when the water evaporated in the spring and the sun baked the ground hard, the lake beds became the greatest natural landing fields ever discovered, and also the biggest, with miles of room for error. That was highly desirable, given the nature of the enterprise at Muroc. Besides the wind, sand, tumbleweed, and Joshua trees, there was nothing at Muroc except for two Quonset-style hangars, side by side, a couple of gasoline pumps, a single concrete runway, a few tar paper shacks, and some tents. The officers stayed in the shacks, marked barracks, and lesser souls stayed in the tents and froze all night and fried all day. Every road into the property had a guardhouse on it manned by soldiers. The enterprise the Army had undertaken in this godforsaken place was the development of the supersonic jet and rocket planes. At the end of the war, the Army had discovered that the Germans not only had the world's first jet fighter, but also a rocket plane that had gone 596 miles an hour in test. Just after the war, a British jet, the Gloster Meteor, jumped the official world speed record from 469 to 606 in a single day. The next great plateau would be Mach 1, the speed of sound, and the Army Air Force considered it crucial to achieve it first. The speed of sound, Mach 1, was known, thanks to the work of physicist Ernst Mach, to vary at different altitudes, temperatures, and wind speeds. On a calm 60-degree day at sea level, it was about 760 miles an hour, while at 40,000 feet, where the temperature would be at least 60 below, it was about 660 miles an hour. Evil and baffling things happened in the transonic zone, which began at about 0.7 Mach. Wind tunnels choked out at such velocities. Pilots who approached the speed of sound in dives reported that the controls would lock or freeze or even alter their normal functions. Pilots had crashed and died because they couldn't budge the stick. Just last year, Geoffrey de Havilland, son of the famous British aircraft designer and builder, had tried to take one of his father's DH-108s to Mach 1. The ship started buffeting and then disintegrated, and he was killed. This led engineers to speculate that the shockwaves became so severe and unpredictable at Mach 1, no aircraft could survive them. They started talking about the sonic wall and the sound barrier. So this was the task that a handful of pilots, engineers, and mechanics had at Muroc. The place was utterly primitive, nothing but bare bones, bleached tarpaulins, and corrugated tin rippling in the heat with caloric waves. And for an ambitious young pilot, it was perfect. Muroc seemed like an outpost on the dome of the world, open only to a righteous few, closed off to the rest of humanity, including even the Army Air Force brass of command control, which was at Wright Field. The commanding officer at Muroc was only a colonel, and his superiors at Wright did not relish junkets to the Muroc rat shacks in the first place. But to pilots, this prehistoric throwback of an airfield became shrimp heaven, the rat shack plains of Olympus. Low-rent septic tank perfection. Yes. And not excluding those traditional essentials for the blissful hot young pilot. Flying and drinking and driving. Just beyond the base to the southwest, there was a rickety, windblown 1930s-style establishment called Poncho's Fly-In, owned, run, and bartended by a woman named Poncho Barnes. Poncho Barnes wore tight white sweaters and tight pants after the mode of Barbara Stanwyck in Double Indemnity. She was only 41 when Yeager arrived at Muroc, but her face was so weather-beaten, had so many hard miles on it, that she looked older, especially to the young pilots at the base. She also shocked the pants off them with her vulcanized tongue. Everybody she didn't like was an old bastard or a son of a bitch. People she liked were old bastards and son of a bitches, too. I told that old bastard to get over here and I'd give him a dink. But Pancho Barnes was anything but low rent. She was the granddaughter of the man who designed the old Mount Low cable car system, Thaddeus S.C. Lowe. Her maiden name was Florence Leontine Lowe. She was brought up in San Marino, which adjoined Pasadena and was one of Los Angeles's wealthiest suburbs, and her first husband, she was married four times, was the pastor of the Pasadena Episcopal Church, the Reverend C. Rankin Barnes. Mrs. Barnes seemed to have few of the conventional community interests of a Pasadena matron. In the late 1920s, by boat and plane, she ran guns for Mexican revolutionaries and picked up the nickname Pancho. In 1930, she broke Amelia Earhart's airspeed record for women. Then she barnstormed around the country as the featured performer of Pancho Barnes' Mystery Circus of the Air. She always greeted her public in jodhpurs and riding boots, a flight jacket, a white scarf, and a white sweater that showed off her terrific Barbara Stanwyck chest. Pancho's desert fly-in had an airstrip, a swimming pool, a dude ranch corral, plenty of acreage for horseback riding, a big old guest house for the lodgers, and a connecting building that was the bar and restaurant. In the bar room, the floors, the tables, the chairs, the walls, the beams, the bar were of the sort known as extremely weather-beaten, and the screen doors kept banging. Nobody putting together such a place for a movie about flying in the old days would ever dare make it as dilapidated and generally go to hell as it actually was. Behind the bar were many pictures of airplanes and pilots, lavishly autographed and inscribed, badly framed and crookedly hung. There was an old piano that had been dried out and cracked to the point of hopeless desiccation. On a good night, a huddle of drunken aviators could be heard trying to bang, slosh, and navigate their way through old Cole Porter tunes. On average nights, the tunes were not that good to start with. When the screen door banged and a man walked through the door into the saloon, every eye in the place checked him out. If he wasn't known as somebody who had something to do with flying at Muroc, he would be eyed like some lame goddamn mouse shit sheepherder from Shane. The plane the Air Force wanted to break the sound barrier with was called the X-1S at the outset, and later on simply the X-1. The Bell Aircraft Corporation had built it under an Army contract. The core of the ship was a rocket of the type first developed by a young Navy inventor, Robert Traw, during the war. The fuselage was shaped like a 50-caliber bullet, an object that was known to go supersonic smoothly. Military pilots seldom drew major test assignments. They went to highly paid civilians working for the aircraft corporations. The prime pilot for the X-1 was a man whom Bell regarded as the best of the breed. The man looked like a movie star. He looked like a pilot from out of Hell's Angels. And on top of everything else, there was his name, Slick Goodlin. The idea in testing the X-1 was to nurse it carefully to the transonic zone up to 7/10, 8/10, 9/10 the speed of sound, 0.7 Mach, 0.8 Mach, 0.9 Mach, before attempting the speed of sound itself, Mach 1. Even though Bell and the Army already knew the X-1 had the rocket power to go to Mach 1 and beyond, if there was any beyond. The consensus of aviators and engineers after Joffrey de Havilland's death was that the speed of sound was an absolute, like the firmness of the earth. The sound barrier was a farm you could buy in the sky. So Slick Goodlin began to probe the transonic zone in the X-1, going up to 0.8 Mach. Every time he came down, he'd have a riveting tale to tell. The buffeting. It was so fierce, and the listeners, their imaginations aflame, could practically see poor Joffrey de Havilland disintegrating in midair. And the goddamn aerodynamics, and the listeners got a picture of a man in ballroom pumps skidding across a sheet of ice, pursued by bears. A controversy arose over just how much bonus Slick Goodlin should receive for assaulting the dread Mach 1 itself. Bonuses for contract test pilots were not unusual, but the figure of $150,000 was now bruited about. The Army balked, and Yeager got the job. He took it for $283 a month, or $3,396 a year, which is to say, his regular Army captain's pay. The only trouble they had with Yeager was in holding him back. On his first powered flight in the X-1, he immediately executed an unauthorized zero-G roll with a full load of rocket fuel, then stood the ship up on its tail and went up to 0.85 Mach in a vertical climb, also unauthorized. On subsequent flights at speeds between 0.85 Mach and 0.9 Mach, Yeager ran into most known airfoil problems. Loss of elevator, aileron and rudder control, heavy trim pressures, Dutch rolls, pitching and buffeting, the lot. Yet, was convinced after edging over 0.9 Mach that this would all get better, not worse, as you reached Mach 1. The attempt to push beyond Mach 1, breaking the sound barrier, was set for October 14, 1947. Not being an engineer, Yeager didn't believe the barrier existed. October 14 was a Tuesday. On Sunday evening, October 12, Chuck Yeager dropped in at Poncho's along with his wife. She was a brunette named Glennis, who he had met in California while he was in training. And she was such a number, so striking. He had the inscription Glamorous Glennis written on the nose of his P-51 in Europe. And just a few weeks back, on the X-1 itself. Yeager didn't go to Poncho's and knock back a few because 2 days later the big test was coming up. Nor did he knock back a few because it was the weekend. No, he knocked back a few because night had come and he was a pilot at Muroc. In keeping with the military tradition of flying and drinking, that was what you did, for no other reason than that the sun had gone down. You went to Poncho's and knocked back a few and listened to the screen doors banging and to aviators torturing the piano and the nation's repertoire of familiar favorites and to lonesome mouse-turd strangers wandering in through the banging doors and to Poncho, classifying the whole bunch of them as old bastards and miserable peckerwoods. That was what you did if you were a pilot at Muroc and the sun went down. So about 11, Yeager got the idea that it would be a hell of a kick if he and Glennis saddled up a couple of Poncho's Dude Ranch horses and went for a romp, a little rat race in the moonlight. That was in keeping with the military tradition of flying and drinking and drinking and driving, except that this was prehistoric Muroc and you rode horses. So Yeager and his wife set off on a little proficiency run at full gallop through the desert in the moonlight amid the arthritic silhouettes of the Joshua trees. Then they start racing back to the corral, with Yeager in the lead and heading for the gateway. Given the prevailing conditions, it being nighttime at Poncho's, and his head being filled with a black sandstorm of many badly bawled songs and vulcanized oaths, he sees too late that the gate has been closed. Like many a hard-driving midnight pilot before him, he does not realize that he is not equally gifted in the control of all forms of locomotion. He and his horse hit the gate, and he goes flying off and lands on his right side. His side hurts like hell. The next day, Monday, his side still hurts like hell. It hurts every time he moves. It hurts every time he breathes deep. It hurts every time he moves his right arm. He knows that if he goes to a doctor at Muroc or says anything to anybody even remotely connected with his superiors, he will be scrubbed from the flight on Tuesday. They might even go so far as to put some other miserable peckerwood in his place. So he gets on his motorcycle, an old junker that Poncho had given him, and rides over to see a doctor in the town of Rossaman, near where he lives. Every time the goddamn motorcycle hits a pebble in the road, his side hurts like a son of a bitch. The doctor in Rossaman informs him he has two broken ribs, and he tapes them up and tells them that if he'll just keep his right arm immobilized for a couple of weeks and avoid any physical exertion or sudden movements, he should be all right. Yeager gets up before daybreak on Tuesday morning, which is supposed to be the day he tries to break the sound barrier, and his ribs still hurt like a son of a bitch. He gets his wife to drive him over to the field, and he has to keep his right arm pinned to the side to keep his ribs from hurting so much. At dawn, on the day of a flight, you could hear the X-1 screaming long before you got there. The fuel for the X-1 was alcohol and liquid oxygen. Oxygen converted from a gas to